At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in German Studies. I'm Craig Servillo, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Sandra Ott about her excellent new book, Living with the Enemy, German Occupation, Collaboration, and Justice in the Western Pyrenees, 1940 to 1948, published by Cambridge University Press in 2017. Dr. Ott, hello, and welcome to the show.
Oh, hello. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, well, no, it's our pleasure. I'm glad to have you. Dr. Ott, we like to always begin these interviews by having the author tell us something about themselves.
Well, I grew up in Pennsylvania in a very small town and went to Pomona College in California as an undergraduate, where I read English with an emphasis in creative writing. And I then, in my junior year, went to the Outer Hebrides, which was my first taste of anthropological fieldwork. From Pomona, I went to Oxford University and did all of my graduate work there. And during the course of my fieldwork for my master's, my MLit at Oxford, I worked on an Irish Gaelic-speaking island off the coast of Donegal in Ireland. And then for my DPhil at Oxford, I went to the French Basque Country for the first time as an anthropologist, as a social anthropologist. And I worked in a Pyrenean community that was really at the end of the road in those days in 1976, lived with a family for just over a year. And I have been back to that Basque community every year since 1976. And because I lived in Britain for almost 30 years, it was easy for me to go back to the Basque country on a regular basis. And during the course of writing my second book, I really became interested in archives. My second book is really a study of four different French Basque communities and how their members responded to the Germans during the German occupation. And this particular book that's just come out is the product of that early interest in archival research. So I'm a social anthropologist who has one foot in anthropology and ethnography, and also I feel like I'm an adopted historian, which is an exciting new field for me.
Fascinating. So you mentioned that this particular book has come out of your research in the archives and sort of your long-standing trips to this region. I'm wondering if you can elaborate on what kept you going back to that region, and talk about the nature of the people there and the people you've come to know. Just give the listeners a little bit of an overview on why you became so interested in that region.
Yes. In the 1970s, when I was doing field work for my first book, the people of this particular mountain community were very, very welcoming. They are very culturally proud people. They were eager to teach me the Basque language. I learned Basque through French. And they taught me so much about their local way of life and the rituals that were very important to them. And in the 1970s, I just caught that particular Basque community at a time of real change. Many of their customs and practices were falling into disuse. Roads were coming through. People were beginning to acquire telephones and cars. And during the course of those conversations in the 1970s about their community, their culture, their language, the elderly people would often refer to the dark times of the 1940s. And at that particular time, I was focused on doing a conventional ethnographic study of that community. And while interested in the historical background to the community, the Second World War was certainly far from a focus of intellectual interest for me at the time. But nevertheless, as Oxford taught me to appreciate that nothing is unimportant when you're doing field work, I took field notes about comments on the German occupation. So my field notes go back to the to 1976. During that 1976, 77, 78, when I was working on finishing my DPhil dissertation, people then would catch themselves talking about the German occupation, and they'd say, "Oh, Sandy doesn't need to know that," and they would change the topic of conversation. I never initiated those conversations. They were just things that they were that obviously were on their mind. And they said, "Sandy, it's really too soon for us to talk about these things." And during that initial period of field work, I worked a lot in the town hall archives, and was as anthropologists do, I was collecting genealogical information from the birth, marriage, and death records. And I came across an entry in the ledger of deaths for the 1940s, and I came across the name of a young man, age 19. And the priest had written in the margin, died in Buchenwald in August 1943. And I went back to my Basque household, and the woman of the house was always very interested in knowing what I was learning, both out of self-interest and just curiosity. And I asked her about the case of this young man, and she was hesitant and said, that was a very hard period. There was a local denunciation. And hers was a community so tightly knit and in which there was tremendous community solidarity. So a betrayal always strikes at the heart of any small face-to-face community, and certainly that was the case here. And she was reluctant to tell me the whole story, and it took me about 5 years of going back every summer at every opportunity. And gradually I pieced the story together. And it was a very tragic one in which the father of this young man apparently denounced him to the Germans and denounced the young neighbor as well. Both of them perished. So it was a very divisive time, but one that the people of this community overcame. And my relationship with the people was solidified not only by my constant interest in them and affection for them, but my first book, The Circle of Mountains, was also translated into French, and it would be a bestseller if it were still in print, because the people over there really love that book, because it is a glimpse into a past that many of them, the younger generations, don't know about. So I've been glad to have made a contribution like that to them. And I also made an ethnographic film with Granada Television in the 1980s about this community. And of course, I showed them two versions of the film before it was aired in Britain. And that again is something that they have really appreciated as a cultural treasure for them. And it is still shown in the Basque Country as a lens through which to understand the way life was back, many decades ago. And of course, I've just celebrated something like 43 years knowing these people, and I carried the three grandchildren in my current household there to their baptisms. I've been to weddings, funerals, and even though I now live in Reno, I'm back there every summer. And when I had a gap in my academic career, I was a university administrator at Oxford for 13 years, and when I came back to the University of Nevada in Reno, that's when I had a chance to shift from social anthropology into history. I had decided to focus on the experience of German occupation, so combined field work with archival research. And in 2003, when I started my field work again, of course, I had been back every year. But when I told them what my new research interest was, the German occupation, the experience of daily life under German occupation, the people said, oh, Sandy, now it's you're too late. It was too soon in 1976, and they lamented that now it was going to be too late because so many people had died already. So their response to me, my interest in a very difficult topic, because it entailed not only what constituted resistance, but also what constituted collaboration. I had many people coming to me, wanting to talk to me, and so that was my second book, and it was the first step for me in understanding the occupation. I combined field work with those men and women who had direct experience of the Germans, either as children or as younger adults, and sometimes as older adults, and that was that provided a really firm groundwork as well for the book that's just come out. And I am very gratified that people trusted me, and they would often say, we're glad that you're writing this book because it's really time that people understood what happened in these difficult times. There are ethical issues involved in working on something that involves tragic events in people's lives, and people did things that they would probably be very unlikely to do in times of peace. And anyway, the research for the current book really made me I laughingly say an archive junkie, because the archives are such fun to work in, and trial dossiers were an anthropological treasure for me, especially when they contain letters and photographs and the kinds of things upon which I could draw to reconstruct the experience of daily life during the occupation and also the post-liberation years.
Thank you for sharing in that level of detailing. I think it's important for people listening to understand that not only when we do these large projects, that we're dealing with real people, with real lives. They're not some abstract thing. And, you know, they have reactions and stories to tell. And you've given, obviously, lots of your life to this one topic. And I think it's important for people to hear that. Thank you for sharing. To go back to a little more general question, this region of the world may not be a place that a lot of people are real familiar with. So if you could just give a few minutes on sort of the historical background of this region, why it's historically important, what are some of the conflicts, and what are some of the languages spoken there?
Sure. There are seven provinces in the entire Basque Country, three of which are located in southwestern France, and that, of course, is the area in which I specialize. And the three French Basque provinces are run inland from the coastal communities of Bayonne and Biarritz. And the community the province in which I've mainly worked is Chiburoa, which is the easternmost in the highest part of the Basque Pyrenees. And it's a borderland region that is very, very unlike other parts of France in a number of ways. The Basque language is not Indo-European. It is it's a language unto itself. And it is also, as a borderland, an area of multilingual and multicultural people. And certainly from, you know, the first half of the 20th century, with the First World War, the Spanish Civil War, and then on its heels, the beginning of the Second World War, there were many, many different nationalities in that part of southwestern France. There were White Russians, there were people from different parts of Eastern Europe, people, displaced people. And so it was it's an unusual region because of that. And also in terms of the context for my own work on the German occupation, you know, there was a huge exodus of exiled Spanish Republicans who fled Franco from 1937, 1938, and 1939. And so many of whom stayed in that part of southwestern France. And their story is also part of the stories that I try to tell about the experience of the German occupation. And so the Basques are culturally, they're also culturally very unlike other parts of France. With they have a very distinctive culture in terms of what's important in the rural. It's very rural in the French Basque country. The house gives one an identity and a name, and neighbor relationships are extremely strong. And you don't find that kind of close social relationship and community quite the same in other parts of France, and certainly not in Spain. So it's culturally a unique area, I think.
Can I ask a follow-up? You mentioned in the book in the early stages, I believe in the introduction, that even though they are so culturally different, that World War I was a sort of very important experience for people in the Basque region, that they sort of felt more French during the war. Was that something that was sustained, or was it just a brief moment of patriotism?
No, I think I really think it was the starting point for French Basques to feel French for the first time in a very significant way, because so many French Basque men were drafted, called up to serve France, and many of them didn't speak French. And can you think of anything more terrifying than the possibility of going into the trenches and not being able to understand your commanding officer? And, you know, the men had also never traveled much. That it is a part of the world in which, even up into the 1970s, many people who stayed there, their social universe was very small. So the First World War, that together with emigration to South America and North America, certainly widened horizons. And there was a high desertion rate among French Basques during the First World War, because many of them did not think it was their war and did not want to fight for France. So they would either hop over the Pyrenees into Spain and stay with smugglers they knew or relatives they had there, or they would often emigrate to the American West, where there were already Basques known. The chain migration certainly increased because of the desertion rate. But it was they really irritated the French authorities because they did not feel, some of them did not feel French. But those who did fight really they had to learn French, and they came back with a different sense of the world. And I think that was a turning point in terms of how they saw themselves. They still saw themselves as Basque first in most cases. But there was an attachment then to France that was new.
Has there ever been a serious movement for independence?
There have been movements that advocated for autonomy that were sympathetic to the Basque nationalist movement on the other side, the southern side of the Basque country. But it's never really taken root in the same way. The people are very culturally proud, but they... And now they understand that the world has changed very much. Of course, now people are much more in touch with what the world around them. But in the 70s, for example, I mean, there were only two cars in the community. We had two telephones. And so it was very isolated. I remember I worked for 3 years in San Sebastian in the southern Basque country in Spain. And when I would go back to this French Basque community at weekends, they really didn't have a sense of what I was doing and what it meant to be in the Spanish Basque country, because they'd been the other side of the mountains in the opposite village to sell their cheeses or to work as cheesemakers, but otherwise they weren't entirely clued up with what was going on the other side. I just speak of people who are farmers and shepherds. You know, these are people whose primary concern are the sheep and the cheese and running the farm and the weather. because it's a very rural area.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you for clarifying. I wasn't sure. I was curious if, cause I know that in Spain there's more of this clamoring for autonomy. The Catalonians, for example.
Well, Basques today on both sides of the Pyrenees are watching Catalonia with interest, I'm sure.
With interest. Yeah. So you sort of, mentioned in your last two answers that sort of community hospitality are sort of central to their culture. And you, in the beginning of your book, discuss that you rely on sort of these anthropological concepts, hospitality, and gift exchange, just to name two. I'm wondering if you can explain those a little bit to people who, again, may not be as familiar with the concepts that you're using.
As I tell my students here at UNR, be glad that you don't have an anthropologist trying to study you. We're very much a nuisance because we have to learn the language and we follow our informants around to understand their way of life. And that's exactly what I did in the 70s. And I'm a fixture there now. But when you do field work, you are constantly engaged in what we call observation participation. You're taking part in life. I learned how to herd sheep. I was a disaster at milking sheep. They took that task away from me because the ewes too often got cross and kicked my bucket and I lost my milk. But as an anthropologist, you to me, if you do it properly, you engage in the way of life, and then you understand things like the importance of you watch people and how they interact with each other. And I got to understand Basque hospitality, which is there are certain rules, as there are in most societies, for welcoming someone to your table. Certainly, getting past the farmhouse door, if you get inside, that's the first step. And if you're offered food and drink, that is a sign of acceptance. Just to illustrate the importance of hospitality, and it does enter into this new book of mine. I was sitting at the table in my first farmhouse with the widow, who was my hostess, and a young French PhD student from Paris arrived unannounced, and he came in, and my hostess had heard about him. He'd been living in a neighboring village for about the same period of time as I at that stage, but he spoke absolutely no Basque, and the people of this community were very proud of me that I spoke Basque. I learned Basque. I made a lot of mistakes, which endeared me to them because I could laugh at myself. But this young man came in, and she, out of courtesy to me, invited him in, and he sat at the table. But she didn't offer him any food or bread or cheese, which is, wine, bread, or cheese. And that is the normal thing. If you get inside a Basque farmhouse, that's what you're offered any time of day. And so he knew so little that he didn't even know how deeply insulted he was, how insulting she was to him. And then to top it all, she asked me in Basque to go herd the sheep. And she knew that he had street shoes on and had no idea how to herd sheep. And the poor man just had a terrible time. And he came back and she still didn't offer him anything to eat or drink. And there's an example of when the door is, closed, you're not accepted. So when I started working in the archives on the German occupation, I had what I call an ethnographer's eye. I'm looking into the archives for things that relate to Basque culture, such as offers of hospitality and what I call commensality, the act of eating and drinking together, and also gift exchange, because in my anthropological fieldwork, much of my first book was about gift exchange in this particular community. They exchanged gifts of blessed bread every Sunday, and it was called the gift of life. So I knew anthropologically I had background on the importance of gift giving and reciprocity. And the same thing happens in rural Basque culture in the 70s, up until very recently. Particular neighbors it returned the favor by helping with the experience of death. When a household lost one of its members, the neighbor would take over the work of the house and the farm. So there are all kinds of examples of gifts being exchanged, and gifts not in the sense only of physical objects like blessed bread, but also services. And so when I read the archives pertaining to the occupation and these dossiers, I was looking for the ways in which people created social relationships with one another. And people do that through things like eating together, drinking together, exchanges of hospitality, exchanges of material objects and services. So I read the archives in a different way from a traditional, even a social historian, I think. And sometimes my colleagues in French history tease me and say, how on earth do you have the patience to, you know, figure out who knew whom and, you know, try to trace patterns of sociability. But that's a lot of the kind of research that I did for this book.
You mentioned also in the book that the Germans, even before the Nazi period, had a tremendous interest in this region. They would send people there to learn the language, learn the culture. I'm wondering if you can explain us why that is. Where did that start?
Yeah, I was fascinated by this too. I hadn't appreciated it before. But the German scholars, going back to Humboldt even, they're very much interested in the Basque language, both, you know, from the 18th century, 19th century. There were several departments, linguists who focused on the Basque language. Basque was taught in a number of German universities in the 19th and 20th centuries. Long before even the First World War, had an intellectual interest in the Basque notion of homeland, and some Germans saw it as very similar to the German notion of Volk, and the German notion of community. And of course, as Hitler came to power, that all took on a new kind of interest with the rise of National Socialism, and some Nazis looked to the Germans as a possible people who would fit in their new order for Europe as Aryans, because there was in Basque nationalism in the late 19th century a singularity of being Basque as a race, and the Germans took a particular twist on the Basque race as being special and superior. That was their own twisting of the notion of Basque race, but they tried to, some saw it as fertile grounds for being part of Hitler's new order. That never gained ground.
I was very interested that sort of Werner Best took a real keen interest in this region, and sort of looked out for it and thought that they could somehow be their own thing under, you know, a German occupied or dominated Europe. It was something that was totally new to me. I didn't realize that they had such a profound interest in this area for so long. And then, so that leads me now. We'll jump a little bit forward. So we have the war. France loses. They're occupied. In a general sense, is occupation, German occupation in the Basque area, like for the average person, given what you just explained, that they sort of saw them as racial equals, sort of had an affinity for their culture and their language and so forth?
And I think it's important to remember that didn't include all Germans certainly all the Germans who were posted there as soldiers during the occupation. Almost with very few exceptions, the Basques certainly did not welcome the occupiers. Because of their own sense of cultural distinctiveness and what region likes to be occupied by a foreign authority, in having lost a war, having your houses and your businesses requisitioned by the occupying authorities. I think the general message from, and this varied across France, but in that part of southwestern France, the Basque coast was occupied straight away in June of 1940, and there was a concentrated German presence on the coast certainly from the beginning probably created many more tensions than were felt eventually in the interior lands where there were fewer Germans. And how people react to the Germans very much depended upon how the Germans behaved. And to begin with, by all accounts, and this, I think this was, it varied across France, but often the Germans to begin with were courteous and liked to present themselves as, you know, the polite, well-turned-out victor. And sometimes that impressed people. And as the occupation went on, certainly by 1942, tensions increased, and once German violence against local people began to take place, attitudes harden. But the experience of occupation for so many was a matter of getting on with life. You know, you've got to make the best of your circumstances. You don't want the Germans around, but they're there. And what do you do? And so I found in the dossiers and also in listening to people who had direct experience of the occupation that you, as I said earlier, you made choices that you wouldn't ordinarily be forced to make. And you did things that some you probably would never have dreamt of doing to protect your own interests, those you loved. And people often, the one thing I wanted to emphasize to you too is that unlike other parts of France, German officers who were posted to the Basque Country often had very long deployment there. And some of the Germans about whom I've written in this book were there for a year and a half, sometimes almost 2 years. And these are small face-to-face communities, so they became naturally pretty well acquainted with local people because they're around and they need to buy things. They, you know, they are in the village square. They are in the post office. You know, they're there. And the other striking thing is that so many of them were multilingual. And one of the Germans about whom I write learned Basque, which is a difficult language. He also was fluent in English, Spanish, and French. So that made the experience of occupation quite different from other parts of France where Germans were only fleetingly stationed to certain places and were very much more on the move than they were in this Pyrenean borderland. So that adds a different layer. And I think going back to your earlier point about why this is an unusual region and why the occupation was a little unusual there, the duration of the German stay there, I think, again, affected the way people responded to them and the events that happened. I haven't mentioned resistance. There was, of course, armed resistance.
That was my next question about resistance.
Yeah. I wrote much more about the resistance in my second book, War, Judgment, and Memory in the Basque Borderlands. And there were two resistance groups that were active in the easternmost Basque province. That was de Gaulle's Secret Army and a right-wing, very conservative, mainly outsider resistance group that operated all across France, but they were outsiders, and that's important to understand as opposed to insiders, local men and women. And there was terrible rivalry between the two movements. There was also a communist-led resistance group. So there were three main active ones, and people are still uncomfortable about the animosity and rivalry that divided those three resistance groups. And sometimes they had very serious clashes sometimes about strategy and how to proceed against the Germans. So that was an interesting part of my field work.
Would you say that resistance in that region was effective? Any more or less more effective or less effective than sort of wider France?
Oh, I don't think it was anything on the scale of what when found in central France, near Clermont or Lyon. They were local. It was very, very local. And they did carry out acts of sabotage and they harassed the Germans. They did help to liberate their communities. Although when one points out to them, the Germans actually did leave of their own accord. they're very proud of the fact that they did actively, a large number of them did actively resist. And the other thing, interesting thing about the resistance there, when I talked to and listened to elderly resistors, there were quite a few women who took part in the resistance, and they were very reluctant to tell their stories. They always deferred to the men, which was very unlike Basque women, because Basque women are normally, regard themselves on equal footing to their menfolk. But in this case, it was curious, and the men would always come forward, and they, je fais la résistance. I was in the resistance, and they would switch from Basque to French to tell me about their experiences. And I think that goes back to our point about World War One, and how that experience of war made men feel French for the first time in a significant way. And I picked up on it when they would describe their resistance exploits and would revert to French as the language of, as the descriptive language.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say about the women. Finally, I did get women to tell me about what they had done. And, some of them would ride bicycles for 60 miles carrying messages on their bikes to different, either for working for an intelligence agency or network. And there were many trans-Pyrenean intelligence networks. So women did play a major part in resistance as well as the men.
I was going to ask if any of the women had eventually opened up to you as to why they didn't want to talk about their activities in the resistance, why they deferred.
I think they were being very humble. I mean, it was, I think it was humility more than anything. I don't think they weren't bothered about claiming acts of heroism. They were very adamant not to be doing that. They said, when you know you have to do something, you do it. But their take was very different from the men. The men wanted credit. it was quite interesting.
So now let's turn to the heart of your book, the second section where you have the case studies. And one of the things I really liked about that you included in the book was a list of all the names of all the actors in each chapter. It really helps you keep all the players straight. That was great to have that in the front of the book. And obviously you had 7 or 8 case studies, so we can't talk about them all. I'm wondering if you could pick 1 or 2 of your favorites and discuss those a little bit, and I'll ask you some follow-ups. I didn't want to go through the process of picking specific ones because I wanted to hear what ones you really would like to emphasize.
I guess I would start with the one that first piqued my interest in the archives, and that is the case of the spinster in the city of Po who befriended a Nazi officer. And I found that was the first dossier I opened. At that time I wasn't focusing on the dossiers, but that's the one that got me hooked. So I'll say a few words about it. In the dossier, I found 29 letters from the Nazi officer to this woman in Po, and I thought that was an amazing window into a Franco-German friendship. And the dossier, the story, is a very interesting lens into how women, French women, and German soldiers sometimes became friends, and these two clearly were friends. I don't think they were lovers, but the Nazi officer was certainly manipulative. As you know, having read the book, he would begin his letters to Lulu, is the character's name, by commenting on the friends in common that they had, and their sexual trysts and liaisons, and their follies. And would move on to maybe comment about the war, this wretched war, when's it going to end? And then the German officer would always, in his manipulative way, produce a shopping list for Lulu and say, my dearest Lulu, the terrorists have bombed my hometown, and my poor dear darling wife has lost everything. I've lost my library, my books, my paintings, my works of art, my clothes, my entire world is turned upside down. Can I please borrow another 5,000 francs from you, dear Lulu? And sometimes he would make little drawings in his letters of the things he wanted to acquire, such as 6 knives, forks, spoons because they'd lost their cutlery, or a house coat had so many buttons on it. But the thing he really coveted from her was a bathrobe for his wife, and preferably in pale blue or pink, either would do. And of course, she was trying to provide these goodies for him from the black market. So it's an extraordinarily lopsided friendship that intrigued me greatly. And of course, she and her other female friends, all of whom were socializing with Germans, and each one of them had a different position on whether they were pro-German or not. But she, Lulu, ended up with a quite severe sentence and never tried to defend herself. It's a very curious story, and one that always puzzles my students when we look at these narratives. And I guess another one that I would say is I'm fascinated by them all. Everything from the bicycle vendor who is just making a ton of money off the occupation and meets an unhappy end. And it was early on, and so justice was, justice was not served in that particular case. But the one I want to mention was the one of the Basque farmer, a pro-German Basque farmer. That was such a complicated case. And as I say in the book, the dossier is about as tattered as the lives of those people. It really was a window into the kind of duplicity, the kind of vengeance that was wreaked sometimes. It's not a pretty story, but one in which, a Basque farmer was pro-German, invited Germans to dine at his table. His daughter-in-law was under the same roof, hiding an evader of obligatory work service in Germany, and her husband was working as a clandestine guide to help Jews and Allied pilots over the Pyrenees. So in terms of who was who and on what side, it was a very complicated household, and one in which tragedy occurred. And I think that one of all of them, it focuses the most on the Basque culture and the important, when you do invite a German to your table, what does that mean and how is that viewed by the post-liberation authorities? And it's an extraordinary case because, the man was let off. And it seems pretty clear from the archives that he denounced his own daughter-in-law, and she and her cousin ended up dying in German concentration camps. Anyway, they are, each one of the stories, there's a window into human folly and vengeance and duplicity, and there is quite a lot of sex involved too.
Yes, and I'm glad you brought this particular one up, because I was also very curious as to why he got off, because he was pretty clearly, get from your book, very clearly guilty. So you do something with these stories that's really extraordinary. So you rely on trial testimony, trial documents that you had to get special permission to see. They had been classified. Are they still classified, considered classified now?
Things have opened up even since, certainly in the last 5 years, and I think it was two Christmases ago, many more of the files were opened up. And I'm not sure that all of these are open to the public now, which frustrates some people who want to know about their families. And I have had people ask me if I could help them understand better what happened to their loved ones. I've been very careful about that because I was under oath, so to speak, to protect the identity of people about whom I write. But the archives are much more open now.
So these files aren't even. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. No, I was just going to say that these files are not even open to people who are concerned with their own relatives.
No, and that is. That is something that frustrates family members sometimes. But it's interesting because I had one gentleman come up to me in the archives in Poe, and I'm a familiar face there, and the regular archive readers are working on local history. But he came over to me and he said, "I'm in my 80s, and I understand you're doing research on what collaboration meant during the German occupation." I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "I want to thank you." He said, "It's we've been silent for too long about what happened. And he said, I think it's important that the truth come out. And he said, I'm glad you're American, you're British American, because he said, I don't think if you were French, you'd be so fair in your treatment of these texts. And I said, well, wait for the book before you tell me that. I hope that's what I'm doing. So that was a real expression of trust. I've had other people, you know, say, particularly when they want to vindicate a family member who was wrongly accused of collaboration. But the thing to remember also, Craig, is that the newspapers of the time carry people's names and stories. I mean, you can see who was charged with what, who was accused and being interned. So in a way, it's people could figure out exactly, you know, exactly what was happening to some extent. And some of my Basque friends over there who have read the book and, you know, obviously can read English, and they really would love to have a French edition of it, but I think many of them feel it's still too soon because there are, you know, there's a small world and small face-to-face communities, you know, that people don't know everything. But even if you change people's names and change locations, some of the stories will be familiar enough. It's quite possible that perhaps it is too soon yet, but we'll see.
Right. And so did you find using these documents challenging, you know, with anything having to do with trial testimony? You have to sort of read between the lines and be very careful how you use it. So I assume you were able to, like you mentioned the newspapers, you were able to corroborate a lot of this with other local sources?
Yes, indeed. And I've drawn upon the local press, which of course the local press was extremely political, of course, and censored during the occupation, but the post-liberation press was as well. So I've used the press to a great extent. I've used diaries. I've used letters. The memoirs, a flood of memoirs, you know, came out. Particularly after the year 2000, a lot of self-published memoirs. And you have to be very careful with memoirs because why do people want to tell their version of the story? But they're interesting. And the documents themselves, I've read over 300 of them, of the dossiers, and so, you know, you do have to treat these documents very carefully. You have to remember that they're written looking backwards. They're written post facto. They're as post-liberation, you know, testimonies of the past. And people lie.
Certainly, yeah.
And the case of the black market bicycle vendor who was executed, I came across his main accuser in another dossier completely unrelated, in which he told the same court and some of the same magistrates that somebody else had denounced him. He didn't mention the man's name he'd accused of who got executed. So people, for whatever reason, don't always tell the truth. And in telling the stories, I'm currently writing a paper on the what I call my ethnographic approach to trial dossiers. And how do you find the story? Because I wanted these to be readable and accessible. And it's like detective work because you have to be patient. You have to look at detail and read deeply and widely to try to piece the story together and taking into account the different voices you hear. Because the raw stuff of these narratives are the testimonies of people who either are the accused or people who testified for the prosecution or the defense, and other onlookers who would talk to the police. So, but it's a really rich resource. And of course, the greatest excitement, if you work in archives yourself, you know that it's really fun to get a dossier that's 2 feet thick, and you know it's going to be full of interesting materials. And those are the ones that I've ended up using that have the richest detail that enable me to try to reconstruct what happened and capture a sense of these people's experiences. Of course, there are many silences and gaps. I don't know the whole story in any case. I never will, nor does one when one does field work with real living people. But I hope that these stories offer a good grassroots level glimpse of what it was to be there under German occupation and in that wild post-liberation period.
Fascinating. I was sort of, when I was reading the book and reading that you had gotten special permission to see these documents and going through them all, I was almost excited myself because I've worked in many archives and I too understand the excitement of getting the big files that have lots of things in them. So as a matter of conclusion on this book, and it really is a fabulous book, and I would encourage everybody to go out and get it. What are the couple things that you would like anybody listening today to take away from your book?
I think that my biggest contribution, I hope, is in the telling of these narratives. I don't know of anybody else who's attempted to do quite the same thing, using the documents in this way to reconstruct experiences and all the ups and downs of daily life. And so I think that's what I hope that I will give readers is some more immediate sense of what drove people, what motivated people, the mistakes they made, the luck they had or the bad luck they had, and to really put a human face on writings about the German occupation. I mean, I know the importance of understanding events from the top down, but as an anthropologist, I think my gift can be understanding, helping us to understand in a deeper way what life was like from the bottom up. Because these are ordinary people, and yes, we have previous, there are many works about, you know, the Big Fry, who were well-known, you know, Germans or well-known collaborationists in France. And this is, I think, the first and it's rather unique portrait of ordinary people whose experiences are worth telling, because I think they have much to teach us about the relevance of foreign occupation in our own times in different parts of the world. So I hope it's that human dimension that I can give.
Well, no, I think that's a great message to sort of end discussion of your book on. So traditionally here, we always like to ask, now that you're done with this project and it's been published and out, what are you working on now?
Well, I have to laugh slightly. I am currently interim chair of the communication studies here at the university, but it's a temporary post. I'm helping out the university, but when I can get back to it, I'm actually working on German POWs in post-war France who were posted back to the Basque Country, and this is the next, you know, the sequence to my interest in Franco-German relations and Franco-German-Basque-Spanish relations. So I've been looking at working in the archives in Mont-de-Marsan and Bayonne, as well as in Pau, and trying to piece together the experiences of Basque and French families who found themselves housing German POWs who were sent there to help France rebuild her infrastructure, her roads. They were often used, the German POWs, as to sweep the minefields, a very dangerous task. And so that's an interesting twist, too, on how, you know, the German victor, then vanquished, now as prisoner of war, is coming back into that part of southwestern France. And the oddities I'm finding of sometimes people, the local families, regarding them as members of their family almost. It's quite bizarre. But stay tuned. That's something that on which I'm working, and I'll be over there this summer. We'll be continuing that archival research, and we'll probably work in the archives in Bordeaux as well. And lastly, I am about to embark on a book about cheese. So that is something completely different.
Okay, yeah, we can all get behind that. We can all get behind cheese. Well, both of those sound fascinating. I'm hoping that when you're done, I can have you back on the show and talk about it.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. And no rush, you know. I know you've got lots of things going on. I also want to thank everybody for listening today, and that we will see you all next time.